So hopefully everyone is hearing the audio okay through your phone line. Please let us know via chat if you are having any problems with volume or clarity. We will also be using the chat function in the bottom corner of your screen for questions and comments throughout the webinar. Leslie will be responding to questions as we go this morning, and we will also try to save time for a few questions at the end, but certainly want this to be a dialogue throughout the presentation today. You should have received a copy of Leslie's slides in your reminder email. In case you missed that email, they will also be attached to a confirmation email that confirms your attendance and training hours for today, so check your spam folders following the webinar. We will also be posting a recording of the webinar and Leslie's slides on our website under the Trainings and Events tab, so please check back in a week or two if you would like to access this. If you are sharing a computer with a colleague and either didn't register or didn't log into the webinar using your personal link, please just send me a quick email with your information so we know who all is joining us today, and this also helps us to make sure that everyone on the call receives proof of your training hours. My email is just logan@wcsap.org, logan@wcsap.org. And finally, as always, we would greatly appreciate your taking a few minutes to fill out the evaluation at the conclusion of today's webinar. So the goal of our training today is to provide advocates with information and strategies that can help non-offending parents utilize parenting plans to keep their children safe. Our presenter, Leslie Savina from the Northwest Justice Project, brings a wealth of experience and knowledge on this topic, so we are very lucky to have her with us here to share her expertise. So without further delay, I will turn things over to Leslie.
Okay, good morning. I'm hoping everyone can hear me. This is a little bit of an out-of-body experience for me. I see that there's about 50 people on this webinar right now, and I can't see or hear from any of you. This is very much like having teenagers, which I've had three at one time, and, you know, you talk to them and you get no response. You don't know if they hear what you're saying or not. So, you know, bear with me. I'm a technology immigrant, as my kids tell me, and so this is like a totally new, kind of exciting thing for me. I'm not a good multitasker, and so I'm going to really rely on Logan to help me with the questions, and even if you have to interrupt Logan, please do, because this material is really complicated, and I want people to feel free to ask questions as we go along. Let's see if I can figure out how to get to the next screen. There we are. There's my email at the bottom there, lsavina, first initial, last name, at nwjustice.org. And a big part of my job as the advocacy coordinator for family law in the state of Washington is to really support advocates and attorneys all over the state working in areas of family violence. I try to support your work, and I also learn from your work. My experience is a lot more in the area of domestic violence rather than sexual assault, although there's, if you were to do a Venn diagram of those two areas, as we know, there's a huge connectedness. And because I'm a lawyer, we're just going to have here's the fine print here. I'm not giving legal advice to anybody today. I'm going to tell you what my interpretation of the law is and how I've approached this issue with some of our clients. And I don't know. I think sometimes on these trainings there may be people from other states. I've never practiced in another state, so I'm really going to only address Washington law. That's the good news and the bad news. Washington has pretty great laws to protect children. It's an incredibly complicated statute, and I wish that if I was standing in front of you in a room, I would hold up my photocopy of RCW 2609191, which is the only law I can cite by heart, and it makes me sound really smart. But I usually, because I primarily do domestic violence work, I look at the first page and the last page, and in between, which is what I fondly refer to as the Terminator statute, because it has all sorts of very tough language to terminate, I think, an abusive parent's contact with their children. It's very complicated, and I sort of gloss over it. So for the purposes of doing this training, I had to really map this statute out. And so I wish I could hold up my copy because it's very colorful and charming. So here's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about parenting plans, how to keep children safe in a parenting plan, also how to keep the non-offending parent, who I oftentimes refer to as the protective parent. That's the parent who really, you know, is protecting the child from the abusive parent. And keeping that parent safe is as important as keeping the child safe, because if you have a safe parent, you know that they're going to take care of their kids. So we're going to talk about it. It actually, for those of us who are kind of control freaks, it breaks down pretty naturally into this kind of lovely outline. And it's going to go something like this. We're going to talk first about convictions, what happens when a parent has been convicted of a sex offense. We're going to talk about, for lack of a better word, the really horrible, you know, rape of a child, the worst, most, you know, horrible sex offenses. We're then going to talk about what I refer to as status offenses, which may be, you know, sex between a 19-year-old and a 15-year-old, which may not be appropriate or good or anything that we would recommend, but it's not really one of those horrible make-your-gut-clench crimes. And then when we get finished talking about convictions, which in the legal aid world we refer to those as the easy cases because, you know, you have some real good evidence to go on, then we're going to talk about what happens when a protective parent is concerned that their child has been sexually abused but has no proof. There's no conviction. There may be no forensic evidence, but, you know, the parent has that gut feeling. And that's probably many of our cases. And we're going to talk about what a parent can do in that case to try to draft a protective parenting plan. So let's go. As I said, please ask questions as we go along. So to begin at the beginning, what's a parenting plan? A parenting plan is really almost a contract between the two parents. And it can be very detailed, it can be very loose, but it's really a plan that addresses many of the things you have to do to parent a child. Where does the child go when? Who does the child stay with? How do they go back and forth? Who makes decisions about that child? If there's a dispute about those decisions, how are those resolved? And when a parenting plan is signed by a judge, it becomes a court order. I've had many clients say to me, well, what's a normal parenting plan? And my response to that always is, what's a normal family? I don't know. Mine sure isn't a normal family. So a parenting plan can be as creative, as rigorous, as protective as the particular family needs. It really is a document that should be responsive to the needs of that family and the children in that family. Okay, let's get to the next slide. So what's in a parenting plan? A residential schedule, priorities within that residential schedule. Let's say that 4th of July conflicts with the child's birthday and one parent is supposed to have the child for the 4th of July, one parent's supposed to have the kid for their birthday. How do you resolve that? Are there restrictions? Yeah, there's restrictions, and that's mostly what we're going to talk about. Who drives? How's the child picked up? How's the child exchanged? What if the parents can't have safe contact? How do you do that? Relocation, we're going to talk about that a little bit, because when you're doing a very protective parenting plan, relocation can be a very serious thing. Sometimes a parent needs to relocate to protect them, to protect their child. How can they do that safely and confidentially? Who makes decisions, you know, where does the child go to school? What about non-emergency medical decisions? What about religious upbringing? Some parents say, you know, what about if they want a tattoo before they're 18, or they want to get married, or they want to join the military? So all those things are potential disputes that parents can have. The goal, you know, if it were a perfect world, if it was, I always say the Leave It to Beaver family, but that really dates me, and I don't know, it's not The Simpsons. I don't know who a current kind of very white bread TV family is. But if you're a pretty healthy family, the parents just don't get along anymore, they need to get divorced, the court would look at the goal of encouraging each parent to maintain a loving, stable, and nurturing relationship with the child, consistent with what that child needs and with the child's and the family's social and economic circumstances. So you're it's sort of a whole family approach. It's very healthy. I always use the example of me and my wonderful husband, who's just the nicest, most wonderful guy in the world and a fabulous parent. Should we ever get divorced, not going to happen after 30 years, but should that ever happen, this is what we would look at, who's available to the child when, what are our relationships with the child, that's really a best, what we hope for. Unfortunately, with the clients and the populations we're working with, that's not a parenting plan we get to look at very often. These are factors the court considers when it's looking at creating a parenting plan. The nature of the relationship that the child has with each parent, that's the most important thing. Sometimes the parents agree. I always joke, when my three kids were teenagers, I always said to my husband, look it, dude, you want to leave me? You're going to get custody of the three teenagers. I'll see them on the weekends, and I'll read all those books I always buy at the university bookstore sale. It'll be perfect. That could be an agreement. How much of those parent, what is their parenting function? And who's been taking care of those children on a day-to-day basis? What does the child need? A young child may have very different developmental needs than an adolescent child. Parents' work schedules. If one parent has a more flexible work schedule, maybe they have more time with the children. Children's wishes, if sufficiently mature, that's kind of a red herring, because in Washington State, the courts really don't take the child's wishes into consideration unless the child has talked to a third party, such as a guardian ad litem or a CASA or a family court services social worker. Because oftentimes the child will want to go with a parent who doesn't make them do their homework or eat broccoli. So if the child's, 15, 16, and they have very strong feelings, then, yes, that would be taken into account by a third party, maybe even counsel for the child, depending on the situation, if it's a dependency. But in a regular parenting plan, the court does not want an affidavit from the child or to have the child testify. Because let's face it, kids love their parents no matter what the parents do to them. But before the court, here's the big however, because I'm a lawyer, I love however, and it depends. Before the court creates a parenting plan, the court has to look and see if there's any basis for restrictions in the parenting plan. And that's where the seminar really kicks in, really the subject matter of this seminar. Is there a basis to restrict parents' residential time? Washington, as I said, has a really good statute. There is a must statute. The court must limit a parent's residential time with a child, or if the parent lives with a certain class of persons who have engaged in any of the following conduct. I hope I didn't misspeak that last part, but it is the court must limit basically the offending parent's time. And they have to must limit if any of these four things take place: willful abandonment of the children that continues for a long time, or refusing to perform a parenting function, or physical, sexual pattern of emotional abuse of any child. So it's whether it's the child of that family or it's another child. A history of acts of domestic violence or assault, sexual assault that causes serious bodily harm or fear of such harm, and that would be to the other parent or the other the partner, or if the parent has been convicted as an adult of one of a number of sex crimes. So, and there's certain sex crimes, and they are enumerated in the statute, and I have given you those citations. Logan said some of you may want those. I don't know why, but go ahead, read it. And those are what I would call the most horrible of the sex crimes. And those very bad sex crimes are the ones that have mandatory limitation. Okay. Any questions so far? Just going to give you a minute to type in, and I'm going to see if I can find that little chat box. Okay. I hope everybody's with me. So there also is an opportunity for the court to make non-mandatory restrictions. So in certain cases, I see Dusty, I'm going to answer your question right now. Convicted of a crime against their own child or any child? The answer is yes. So, and we'll talk about that a little more. So if the parent is convicted of a sex crime against their own child, there are limitations or restrictions in the parenting plan, and we're going to get to what they are. But also if the parent is convicted of a sex crime against another child, their time also must be restricted, although those restrictions may be more limited. So there are non-mandatory restrictions. This is really at a court's discretion. If the court finds any of the following, and this is a big laundry list, so the parent neglected or failed to provide for the care of the children, the parent has a long-term emotional or physical problem that interferes with his or her ability to parent the kids, drug abuse, substance abuse that interferes with their ability to parent, no emotional ties, you know, bonding with the kids, abusive use of conflict, which is something I see thrown around liberally. It's pretty hard. I see it oftentimes actually used against my clients who are the protective parent. And when they try to protect their parent, the abusive parent often says, oh, you know, abusive use of conflict, they won't let me see my kid. They're going to court to try to prevent me from seeing my child. So that's a little bit of a two-edged sword. And the abusive use of conflict, you really have to show that it's causing harm to the child. The parent has denied the other parent contact with the child. So, you know, that can be parental kidnapping where the abusive parent takes the child away or, you know, you just don't get to see your child for, you know, it could be days, it could be weeks, it could be in some of my cases months. Or, you know, sort of the catch-all because we love that in the legal world, any other reason that the court finds that it would not be in the children's best interest to have time with that parent. Okay, so far so good. I'm going to just break for questions right there. Okay, I think we're doing all right. So, if there has been a sex offense in the parenting plan, the law requires restrictions in the parenting plan. The nature and extent of the mandatory restrictions, and this is where the law, we're just going to go down the rabbit hole here and bear with me. So, the nature and the extent of these mandatory restrictions are going to depend on the nature of the sex offense. You know, was there, you know, first-degree rape of a child, or was the offending parent looking at pornography on the home computer and the kids saw it? Was there a criminal conviction? And as I said, in the legal aid world, we call those, you know, that's a completely sick thing. We call that a good case because that makes our job much easier. We go in with, you know, proof of the conviction, and the court says, okay, we're going to put in restrictions. That doesn't happen very often. And it also, as Dusty just said in her question, the identity of the victim. Was the victim a child of the relationship? Was it the offender's child, or was it another child? And if it was not the child of the relationship, there will be restrictions, but there is more wiggle room for the parent to argue for more liberal visitation. And here's a question, a really good one, from Libby. To show the history of domestic violence and sexual assault, does the court require the non-offending parent to have documents such as a protection order or police report? If there is no such evidence, will her declaration suffice? Great question, and it's always great if there's a police report, if there's a report from a hospital, a pediatrician, if there's a protection order in place, that is certainly preferable. It's not required. Lots of times, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later, oftentimes in our cases, there's just a parent who has a gut feeling, who has noticed changes in his or her child, and is very concerned that there's been sexual abuse of that child, and there is no documentation. And those are hard cases. Those are just, I hate those cases because so often it comes back to the protective parent who is accused of the abusive use of conflict when he or she is just trying to protect their child. So those are hard cases, but I oftentimes advise my client is, you know, you have to do what you have to do to try to protect your child, and a declaration from a parent is very good evidence. And sometimes it's just all we've got. As we said, the restrictions depend on the offense. And so there is, as you all know, probably better than I do, there's a whole range of sex offenses, you know, first, second, third degree rape of a child, first, second degree sexual misconduct, incest, indecent liberties. Some of them have very funny sexual contact without consent, indecent liberties, molestation. You know, it's sort of a continuum. You know, I know we would all agree that none of these are good. Some of them are much more horrific for a child than others. The less horrific offenses are, I just call, and oftentimes in the prosecutor's word, they're called status offenses. So, you know, if your 15-year-old daughter is dating a 20-year-old, the 20-year-old can be convicted of third-degree rape of a child. You know, it happens. Some of us are married to people who are 5 years older than us, and when you're 30, it's not so bad. When you're 15, it's very inappropriate. But it probably is not as horrible an offense as you know, rape of a six-year-old. As I said before, if the child of the offender was not the victim of the sex offense, then the offending parent has a little bit more wiggle room to advocate for fewer restrictions in the parenting plan, and we're going to talk about how they do that in a minute. And the offender may not be the parent. If the parent resides with somebody, so it could be a roommate, they could be living back at home and their own parent could be a sex offender. It could be their new partner could be a sex offender. I hear that occasionally from fathers where mother has a new relationship and the father may be the protective parent and worried that stepfather or new boyfriend is a sex offender. If that is the case, there still must be restrictions to keep the child safe. And these restrictions are often very similar to the restrictions in place if the parent is the offender. So I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time talking. I'm not going to call out specifically what restrictions would be in place if the roommate or the new boyfriend or somebody living in the household is the sex offender, if the parent is not the sex offender. Just keep in mind that that the restrictions are almost the same. Okay, here's another good question that came. Can you stop visitation of a sibling with the offended parent if one child accuses the parent of sex abuse and has emotional and physical symptoms of trauma when the sibling goes to visit? You know, that's a really good question, and I don't know the answer to that, and maybe somebody else on the call knows the answer. If I were advocating for the protective parent, if I were representing that parent, I would say yes. I would say any time a visitation is causing trauma to a child in the family, the court's duty is to look after the best interests of that child. And you might need to get the child's therapist or counselor or someone to help you advocate to write a recommendation. But I would say yes, that child, you know, that child should not or should have some sort of safety in place for their visitation. So, restrictions in a parenting plan, that's what we're all here about. How do we, you know, if we figure out what the offense is and that there's been a conviction and it's the offending parent and it's the child of the relationship, how do we help our clients craft a parenting plan that has restrictions that are going to keep a child safe? My recommendation is always to be as specific as possible and to focus on keeping both the child and the visiting, the protective parent safe. So whatever that takes, and again, it can be a whole gamut. Once in a while, we get a parenting plan where it just says, it is not safe for this offending parent to have contact with this child. It puts the family at risk. We, you know, no visitation for that. There's the other end of the spectrum where maybe it was a status offense, or maybe it's a roommate, but that roommate is not there, or they would have visitation somewhere else, and the parent can have pretty liberal, unsupervised visitation. But always, because our statute says that if the parent has been convicted of a sexual offense, that parent's time must be limited. My argument to the court, others may disagree with me, but my argument to the court is that the offending parent can never be the primary residential parent. So it's always got to be the protective parent who is the primary residential parent in a parenting plan. If the sexual predator is really a term of art, it's a statutory term, and if the parent has been found to be a sexual predator according to statute, they don't ever have any contact with the child. Period. End of story. Not going to happen. Boy, that's an easy one. That doesn't happen in very many of our cases. I guess maybe that's the good news, but it's, you know, there's this. It's a brief slide. There's just not a lot to talk about here. If a parent is convicted of one of these, what I call the worst offenses, that parent, by statute, the statute said that parent is considered a danger to the child. And so we're going to start with the presumption that that parent should not have any contact with the child. So we're just going to, that's kind of the starting point. You've been convicted of these sexual offenses, and they're all defined in the statute that I cited at the bottom. You know, it's rape of a child, it's first-degree sexual misconduct, it's second-degree child molestation. So if the parent's convicted of one of these, no visitation, but because in the law there's always a but, right? The parent can rebut the presumption of no visitation. So the parent can say, yes, I was convicted of this horrible offense, but I should have contact with my child if, number one, contact is appropriate and poses minimal risk to the child, and you have to have all of these, it's not or, the child is in therapist and the child's therapist approves of the visitation, and the parent is in treatment if he or she was court-ordered and making progress in that treatment, and the treatment provider approves and believes there's minimal risk to the child. So if you look at these, the focus is really on the risk to the child. Can it be done safely for the child? And you need buy-in from people that I term experts, therapists, and treatment providers. So if the offending parent can come to court and say, yes, I did a horrible thing to my child, but I'm in treatment, I'm really making progress, I realized what I did was a horrible thing, you know, I've done my prison time, I've complied with probation and parole, child's in therapy, and I'm going to have visitation in a very safe way, and the child has told his or her therapist that they want it, then okay, goes ahead. So if the parent is able to rebut this, they meet all four of those things, and the court says, okay, you can have visitation, what happens then? How do they have visitation? And again, only supervised visitation. We're not letting this kid go off with this parent who's a pretty high-level sex offender, convicted sex offender. The court may allow, it's a may, not a shall. So it's only supervised visitation. How does supervised visitation work? It's a tricky thing. You know, we've had some conversations in the legal aid world about supervised visitation. What is good supervised visitation? How do you make sure a child's safe during supervised visitation? Frankly, anybody on this call could say, you know, create a website or a business card and say, I'm a visitation supervisor. I could be a visitation supervisor tomorrow. I know nothing about child development or how to keep children safe from an offending parent. But, you know, I could do it. So you really need to look, a protective parent really needs to look at who they're recommending to be the visitation supervisor. I've primarily worked in King County, and even in King County, it's sometimes very difficult to find a supervisor who's going to be protective of the child. We used to have a supervised visitation center that focused primarily on domestic violence. That's not available to us anymore. So I would just really admonish people to make sure that the visitation supervisor is someone who is really going to protect the child and keep the child safe. It shouldn't be grandma. It shouldn't be the person who raised the sex offender. It shouldn't be the protective parent. It probably shouldn't be a family friend. It's in protecting a child in a supervised visitation setting, sometimes you have to be willing to say really hard things to the visiting parent, like, no, you can't put the child in your car and run down to 7-Eleven and get a Slurpee. No, you can't go and you cannot change the baby's diaper. No, you cannot speak Spanish to the child, even though you both speak Spanish, unless we have, you know, a visitation supervisor who also speaks Spanish. So it's a tricky thing to find a neutral, independent adult who's going to protect the child and have a good supervised visitation plan. Doesn't mean you can't do that, but it's tricky. Okay, two good questions. Does supervised visitation cost money, and who pays? Yes, supervised visitation absolutely costs money. I don't know what visitation supervisors are paid. I think maybe for just a private supervisor, it may be in the range of $50 per hour. In my world, legal aid world, where we represent the protective parents and all our clients are low income, we ask the court to order, because this is all going to be pursuant to a court order, we ask the court to order that the offending parent, the visiting parent, pay the cost of supervised visitation. Oftentimes we hear that parent complain that they can't afford it, that it costs a lot of money. I don't know. I mean, I joke about my naughty teenagers, but really, you know, I would crawl over ground glass and, you know, hawk my 18-year-old car to get the money to visit with those kids if that's what it took. So the court will address who's responsible for paying. If both parents have means, you know, if both parents are working, if both parents have money, the court may order supervised visitation to be paid for according to their income. So, you know, it would basically be a child support pro rata share. And I think the thought of the court when they make that kind of order is, this is good for the child, and so both parents should contribute to that. Is there a website that talks about best practices about supervised visitations or classes that are recommended? That was the question. No, not that I'm aware of. There are websites about supervised visitation. I don't think they have a huge amount of credibility. I'm going to say that as diplomatically as possible. We are working in the legal aid world, and I can share it with Logan, who maybe can put it on your website, about a supervised visitation order. this is coming from Safe and Sound, which was a pilot, a federal pilot site for supervised visitation in King County that was up and running for about 5 years until they ran out of funding. And it's an order which basically sets out the responsibilities of the supervisor and what can be expected. And if we can get the courts to buy into that, we're working on a draft right now, that will give a lot of information to both the supervisor and both parents. But right now I'm not aware of any website or any information that I would personally rely upon. And if somebody finds one that they think is good, please share it with me because I would love to know. Okay, moving on. Briefly, if the child was not the victim, so if another child was the victim of the sexual assault, the presumption of no visitation may be, again, be rebutted. It's a little bit different. If contact is appropriate with the child or the family and there's little risk, the parents attending court-ordered treatment and the treatment provider approves. It's the same as if the child, except for this, for if the child was not the victim, if the child was not the victim, it doesn't require the child of who's with whom there's visitation to be in therapy. And there's Karen Wall just put on some a link to some research that Logan's going to put out about a place to find visitation info. Thanks very much for that. I think that's great. And the UW Court Improvement Training Academy, run by Tim Jesko Fisher, is a fabulous resource and has a really great website and listserv if y'all want to hop on that. Okay, is everybody confused? So if a parent is convicted of a sex offense, not against his or her own child, right? So convicted of a sex offense, they're able to rebut the presumption of no visitation, then what kind of visitation would they get? They might be able to argue to the court that they should have unsupervised visitation if, and this is all again statutory, if they've had supervised visitation with their own child for 2 years. So 2 years of successfully supervised visitation and they've been not convicted of certain sex offenses, and those are all enumerated in the statute. And the court finds minimal risk to the child after consultation with experts, and those experts are, again, all set out in the statute. The offending parent has complied with court order treatment. If court order treatment has not been ordered, then the parent has to do a psychosexual evaluation before they would have unsupervised visitation with their child. Okay. Now we're all really confused. So what if a parent is convicted of a lesser offense, of a statutory offense? This is where we get into the discretionary restrictions of the court. It says the parent's residential time shall be limited, but what does that shall mean? It means, in my mind, they're not going to be the primary custodial parent, but what else? What type of limitations are going to keep that child safe? If the parent was convicted, again, we're still talking convictions, of a lesser offense, or the parent's living with somebody. First, as I said, the non-offending parent, so the protective parent, must be the primary residential parent. The offending parent is only going to get some sort of visitation. Second, the most important thing is any limitations that the court puts on the offending parent's visitation must focus on two things: to protect the child from harm and, I think equally as important, protect the non-offending parent from harm. I think sometimes we get really wrapped up in what's going on for the kids that we forget about the protective parent, and it's really important that that parent be kept safe. And good supervised visitation will work hard to keep that parent safe as well. I think many of us are familiar with a parent being killed outside a supervision site in King County. It was many years ago, but it's you know, it happens. Visitation exchanges oftentimes put the protective parent at risk, and it's very important that that parent be kept safe as well. And the third thing is, if the court finds that limitations on visitation won't protect the kid or the parent, the court is able and has authority to restrain the offending parent from all contact with the child, even for a lesser sexual offense. If the court says we can't structure this in a way that keeps the parent and the child safe, then there's no contact. Personally, in my experience, I've gotten that one time in the last 18 years that I've been doing DV and sexual assault work. So it's very, very rare for a court to say no contact. I tend to be a little bit militant about that. I think, and I hear from opposing counsel that parents have rights to have time with their child, have rights to parent their child. My argument is, you know, you waive that right when you hurt a child or hurt the child's parent. So doesn't happen very often, but you can certainly ask for it. What are some limitations that the court could put on visitation with a parent convicted of a lesser offense? Ask for that parent to participate in a domestic violence treatment program, now commonly called Batters Intervention Program. Have that parent participate in substance abuse evaluation and treatment, a sexual deviancy evaluation, and any recommendations that will come out of that, sex offender treatment, and supervised visitation. These are, you know, those are things that I can think of. I'm sure that you can think of others. So before we go on to talk about limitations that you can put in a parenting plan when there's not been a conviction, does anybody have any questions? So what we've just talked about are ways that you can limit visitation to keep a child and a parent safe if the parent was convicted of a sex crime and the limitations are, are related to the nature and the severity of the crime and upon whom the crime was committed. So a serious sex offense with the child of the relationship, no visitation unless the parent can rebut. And if the parent can rebut the no visitation, you can have visitation that's very carefully supervised. If there has been a lesser sexual offense, the parent can argue for unsupervised visitation. But, again, you can ask for limitations. And supervised visitation is going to be at the top of that. They can have unsupervised visitation if they've fulfilled certain requirements of the statute and maybe never and maybe no visitation. So I guess the moral of the story is there's a big range of options to try to keep a parent and a child safe when there's been a sex offense conviction. And what we need to advocate for the families we're working with is what kind of limitations can we reasonably ask for which will keep a child safe. In the cases I work in, more commonly, and I think this was a question earlier, there's no conviction. There may be no forensic evidence, no conviction. I call it the mommy gut feeling. You know, mom or protective parent knows in her heart that something is wrong with her child. She suspects sexual abuse by the other parent or maybe somebody associated with the other parent. So maybe something's happening to the child when it goes over to visit with the other parent. So how does that protective parent keep their child safe in a parenting plan when really there's no conviction and maybe no evidence? And I'm just going to ask for a shout out here and give a little minute for while I have my Marco Rubio sip of water. I'm going to put myself on mute for a minute and just have people type into the chat box and maybe broadcast to all. Logan, I think that will work. strategies people, you all may have used to help keep children safe when sexual abuse has been alleged. Marco Rubio. Okay, thanks for the joke. Okay, so I think in the chat box you can do broadcast to all, and just let's just do what I call a brain dump of ideas that you've had, and we'll talk about those, and then I'll tell you some things that I've used and the various degrees of success. So I'm just going to give a couple minutes of muteness here. Here we go. Okay, you guys are great, and they're still coming in. I'm not sure they went out to all. I think Logan tried to send them out to all, so I'm just going to just, we have actually plenty of time, because I'm more than halfway through my slides, and I guess when I don't have an audience, I go faster. Let's see here. Let's get past the supervised visitation. Praxis. So here are some ideas that people have to help keep kids safe, and these are fabulous. You all think like social workers. I think like a lawyer, so I never would have thought of any of these, and they're way more practical than things that lawyers do. As I always tell my clients, emergency safety planning is worth everything. I can, I can go to court and get an order, and, 250 will buy you a latte, and sometimes they're not effective in keeping people safe. Okay, so here I'm just going to read down the list here. Emergency sexual assault protection orders, emergency modification of a parenting plan, requesting a guardian ad litem to work with the child, again, emergency sexual assault protection orders. Non-offending parents can report their suspicions to CPS, could have CPS do an investigation. In my personal practice, I think CPS can be a two-edged sword. Like anybody who works for the government, they are overworked and underpaid, and sometimes they're a huge help, and sometimes they say, oh, mom's being a protective parent, and they are. They say the child's protective and don't do an investigation, which I feel is very not helpful. This is a great one. Several people said this, sex education at age-appropriate levels, teaching no secrets, surprises are okay, secrets are not okay. Again, someone suggested a GAL. Depending on the age of the child, teach the child how to call 911 for help when they do not feel safe. because I am the meanest mom in the world. Personally, my kids didn't get cell phones until they got their driver's license. I really didn't feel like they needed to be calling people at 2 in the morning. But I have often advocated for clients to get a cell phone, you know, just a minute's cell phone for their kids. You know, pretty little can handle it. 7, you know, can dial. And so to say, you know, I'm not sure I would tell them to dial 911. That can be pretty traumatic for a kid, depending on the situation. But, to, you know, call mom, call me if you don't like the video, if you want me to come and get you, if it's not okay. I'm giving the kid a cell phone. Again, a recommendation, CPS. We teach the child and the parent skills to promote safety and discuss boundaries as well as educate families about abusers. Fabulous. Another, someone who's used a GAL. Safe shelter where the alleged offender will not be able to locate the child and the non-offending parent. We should talk about that, and somebody remind me at the end if I forget, about if you have a parenting plan and the Relocation Act and what triggers then, and how to allow parents to relocate safely without having to trigger a court, going back to court. Again, sex education at age-appropriate levels. Who to report to, educate families about who to report to, and keep reporting until someone listens. Outline of the behavior of the child, including before and after visitation. So I'm thinking that must be just for the protective parent, just to keep a little diary or keep little notes about what the child did, not to maybe quiz a child too much and, you know, trigger something in a child, because that would certainly come up in a court hearing, that, you know, the parent will be accused of planting ideas in the child's mind. But just to, you know, what a child observes. I think we're all pretty intuitive about our kids. Safety planning with the child, age dependent, great. Connect the child to resources such as a school counselor or a therapist. Another great one, use a time frame limitation. If more than 15 minutes late to pick up for a visitation, the visitation doesn't go forward. This is from Timothy Hargraves. The reason it works is that people with low self-esteem are often late. Interestingly, I'm going to tell that to someone I know. Outline behavior, forensic evaluation with a trained counselor to validate and corroborate parent concerns. Great. Talk openly with others that that are around your children and let them know you have talked to your kids about sexual safety and ask that the other also be part of the safety plan. Puts those on alert that you are paying attention. And here's a question at the end of all this. What do you do when you have done all that and the offending parent's attorney argues that is the non-offending parent causing fear or trauma reactions? And, you know, that's a big worry and concern. And so that's why you need to tread really lightly, and I think not to question the children, but to say these are observations that I didn't talk to the child about them. And that's where a counselor for the child or somebody else can corroborate. You know, maybe there's somebody else in the home saying, yes, I was around and I observed that the protective parent didn't quiz the child, didn't plant ideas in the child's mind. You know, child therapists are the best resource, but oftentimes, particularly for low-income clients, they aren't available. The parents don't have access to that. So I think that's a worry, and I'm not sure what you do about that other than, I think Mark Twain said, tell the truth, it's easier to remember. You know, sort of stay the course. And I think keeping contemporaneous notes is really a good thing, because you're not trying to, the parent is not trying to dredge up a memory from last week. They wrote it down, right, you know, date and time, just a brief scribbled note. I often tell my clients to do that, my DV clients to do that, with the understanding that, those can be discovered, you know, so don't put anything in there that you don't want to put opposing counsel or a judge or a guardian ad litem to see. Karen says child advocacy centers are awesome. And I don't really know what child advocacy centers are. So, Karen, you can type in and let us know what those are and how to find an awesome one. That would be great. So those are good strategies to help kids be safe. And I always say self-help, as I said earlier, is you know, worth a thousand times more than anything we can really accomplish in the legal world. But this is really about parenting plans and the court system. So here's the best scenario. If you say to the court, the other parent's not being convicted of a sexual offense, but I have evidence here from a therapist, from CPS, from a forensic evaluator that there has been sexual abuse of this child, bingo. The court is not going to give that parent visitation. It's very easy to say no visitation. But this is the legal world, unless we always leave that door open a crack. Unless an evaluator or a therapist says that the child is ready for contact and will not be harmed. So we come back to that, will it be in the child's best interest? Sometimes those kids, as you all know, I think much better than I know, you know, they never want to see that parent again. It's going to be way too traumatic for that child. Some children need to see that parent. Maybe it's in a therapeutic visitation, maybe it's reunification, but there needs to be someone, not the judge, it needs to be someone who's really an expert in kids saying that this is going to be okay and be safe for the child. If you're helping a protective parent who suspects child abuse, who cannot prove by clear and convincing evidence that there's been sexual abuse, how then are you going to help that parent create a residential schedule, a parenting plan that's going to keep the child safe? And I always come back to be as specific as possible in drafting a parenting plan. If you're very specific, it's going to reduce disagreements. It's going to make, if one parent doesn't follow the parenting plan, it's going to make it easier to go back to court and try to enforce it. And it makes life just easier for the child. So in parenting plans that I draft, I'm oftentimes just totally obsessive-compulsive. The child is returned by the visiting parent to the custodial parent's house at 6:30 p.m. on, you know, first and third Sunday nights. Or the parent will have visitation from after school starting at 3:30, returning the child, specifically date and time, place. The way parenting plans work is who enforces a parenting plan? No one. You know, Big Brother is not going to knock on these parents' doors and say, oh, naughty, naughty, you brought the child back at 7 o'clock and you were supposed to bring the child back at 6:30. Only people who are going to enforce a parenting plan are the parents, and the only way they can do that is by going back to court. Nobody likes to go to court. I'm a lawyer. I don't like to go to court. It can be very traumatic and not fun. If you're a parent whose child has been sexually abused or if the parent has been a survivor of domestic violence, it's even more traumatic to go back to court, to bring the offending parent back into court and argue for contempt. And that's really the only way to enforce a parenting plan if somebody, you know, violates it, if they don't bring the child back. So as somebody suggested earlier, it's really great to write in some provisions. Let's say if the parent is late, the visitation doesn't go forward. If the parent comes to pick up the child for visitation and they're clearly intoxicated or high, the visitation doesn't go forward. But on the other hand, if the visitation is going along and it's going okay, and if the parenting plan very specifically says child should return home at 6:30, but when the visiting parent comes to pick up and says, you know, we're having a family dinner at Aunt Sue's house tonight. Would it be okay if I brought the child back at 7? The primary custodial parent can say, sure, that would be fine. They can modify their parenting plan on the run, and nobody's going to make a problem with that. Sometimes parents will do it in writing just to make sure that they have a record of it. Sometimes email can be our friends in doing parenting plans. I just want to read this about children's advocacy centers that this came up because this is new for me. I guess Logan sent this out. They can assist with protective orders and safety planning. They can also connect with many local service providers, including therapists. Children's advocacy centers are facilities based on multidisciplinary team approach. The facility provides a child-friendly environment for forensic interviewing and a family-friendly waiting areas with services available. Studies are reflecting the child advocacy center is decreasing the need for as many interviews for the child, thereby decreasing additional trauma in child and family. Hooray for child advocacy centers. Thank you for sharing that information. Okay, parenting plans. If the court is going to allow supervised visitation, so protective parent says, I'm concerned that there's been sexual abuse of this child. No, I don't have any evidence. No, there's not a conviction. But this parent has done a lot of things that are very inappropriate. Here is what I know, Your Honor. These are inappropriate things. And I want to keep my child safe. And so here is what I'm asking for the court. And depending upon, again, focusing on what is the need to keep that child and that parent safe, again, there's a continuum. And you can start with saying no visitation. This parent is not responsible. I'm concerned about sexual abuse. This parent also has a history of substance abuse. They are living in a multi-generational home where the child is not well supervised when they're there. Whatever kind of argument you can make, you can say no visitation. That's kind of the most draconian, and that doesn't happen very often. A little bit less draconian is to say, supervised visitation only at a supervised visitation centers. There are a few centers in King County that provide supervised visitation. In smaller towns, more rural areas, that's not going to be an available option. But a supervised visitation center should have good safety protocols in place. And if you're interviewing or looking for one of those, I would just ask them outright. What do you do? What are your policies? What are your protocols? If there is no supervised visitation center, you can ask for the visitation to be professionally supervised. And again, professional supervisors, I could be a professional visitation supervisor. I'm a professional if you pay me, right? You know? And I might be really great, and I might be really lame. So again, I would ask for references, ask for policies, ask for procedures, ask for, you know, kinds of things that they do to keep the child safe. What are their policies? What do they do? Sometimes there's just nothing else out there and the court really wants to give the parent visitation, so the court will order supervised visitation by somebody other than a professional. This may be a friend. It may be a neighbor. Most often it's a relative. Frankly, I'm very uncomfortable with supervised visitation with a relative, because oftentimes they are not going to have the wherewithal to say to the offending parent, you know, as I said before, no, you can't put the kid in the car. No, you can't, you know, lie under the covers and watch a Disney movie with him. You know, they may or they may just say, oh, I really think, you know, parent is fine with the kid. He didn't do anything wrong. I'm just going to run to the grocery store while they're having visitation here. We already went over this before. Visitations by a third party, neutral, confirm their availability when you're asking the court. It's nice if you can do that, to have that arranged beforehand. It's very important to arrange exchanges so the parties if there's safety issues with the non-offending parent, so they don't interact at exchanges. There should be ground rules, you know, things to keep the child safe. Again, you know, what are things that would keep this child safe? Absolutely give the supervisor the authority to suspend visitation, to say, you know, you're behaving inappropriate with the child, please stop that behavior. If they don't stop that behavior, you know, no, the child, it's not okay for the child to sit on your lap while you're having a story. You can sit next to each other on the couch. If the parent doesn't stop that behavior, say, geez, you know, I'm sorry, visitation is over for today. And I talked before about a separate visitation order. That's something that we're working on, so stay tuned for that. I think that they can be very helpful. If the court says, no, I think supervised visitation really isn't needed in this case, you know, I don't think that they're, you know, the protective parent's claim about a sexual abuse, sexual offense, you know, that's, yeah, I think that's pretty sketchy. I think she's just raising that issue because she wants primary custody of the kid, and I think she's just making that up. And I know we've all heard that probably too many times. So if you, you know, there are still ways that you can advocate for keeping a child safe during visitation. And, again, these are just some things that I've thought of, and I'm sure that you have a much better and more comprehensive list than I do. But, no drugs or alcohol during visitation. And if a parent shows up drunk or high, say, no visitation today. The child should always freely have contact with a protective parent during visitation. I know some visiting parents will say, this is my time. I don't want the child calling mom. You know, if there's concerns about child safety, about sexual offenses, the kid should feel safe and that they can call. Maybe they just need to call and check in with mom and say, hey, I'm at the zoo and I'm having a great time. Maybe having visitation in a public place. I don't know. We all sort of behave better in public. I do things at home, you know, that I probably don't do when I'm at the library or I'm at the children's museum or I'm at the McDonald's playground or I'm at a park. It doesn't have to be someplace that costs money like the zoo or the children's museum. There's fabulous parks or McDonald's playgrounds or libraries are great places for kids. Limit third parties present. If there is maybe conflict with the visiting parent and their new partner, this really happens more in DV cases, make sure that that person isn't around. Or if there's allegations also that sometimes step siblings, there's allegations of sexual abuse with that step sibling or inappropriate boundaries, say that that person cannot be there during visitation. Make visitations be short. Again, I think we all behave better for sure. Anybody can kind of keep it together for a few hours. A few hours in a public place is great. You know, if it's a long time, some, you know, kids are hard. Sometimes that they can really push their parents' buttons. Sometimes a parent who may be tempted to inappropriate contact, if visitation's for an hour, they can keep it together for an hour. No overnight visitations, and I love to say that, you know. No, there's just, you don't really, kids sleeping. They don't need to be at your house to sleep. One I didn't put in here is oftentimes having siblings go together. I think that's very protective. Two or three or five kids going to visit with a parent, the kids will look after each other. Singling one child out and sending them for visitation, I think, can be very bad. You know, say right in the parenting plan, you know, don't badmouth the other parent. And I think that applies to both parents. That helps keep the protective parent, not get those allegations of, you know, abusive use of conflict or feeding the child information. And it also, I think, is really a form of abuse and control with abusive parents to demean and downplay the other parents. That's a no-go. Hard to prove, hard to enforce, but sometimes if you just put it in writing, it helps. Children not to be used to relay messages, and those messages can be, it can be a note in the backpack. It can be, this is an example that Tracy Parker from Supervised Visitation uses, the visiting parent wearing a lot of scent, cologne or aftershave, and hugging the kid, and then that smell goes home with the kid, which may be a trigger for the protective parent. That's a message. Most messages are nonverbal. So kids, don't make the kid carry the message. And that also goes for the protective parent. Don't have that parent, tell your dad that I said, no, that's a no-go. Restrictions on time, not only short duration public places, restrict the abusive parent's attendance on the child's school, church, and extracurricular events. Just say, it's not appropriate for the parent to be there. They don't need to be at parent-teacher conferences. They don't need to be in the same church. They don't need to come to the soccer game. Or if they're going to participate in those activities, again, say very specifically what days, times they can go there. So it's very stated very specifically in a parenting plan. And this is to reiterate the phone, Skype contact between the child and the protective parents during visitation. But again, no messages, no quizzing. Kid gets the call, protective parent. Protective parent probably shouldn't be calling the kid unless they're very worried, or maybe once, but they shouldn't be. Where are you doing? Who are you with? That's not a good thing. And this was the same for visitation restrictions when there had been a conviction of a sexual assault. These are the same kinds of restrictions that you can ask. I oftentimes ask for these restrictions in cases where there's been domestic violence. But anytime you're trying to protect a child in a parenting plan, you can ask for a substance abuse evaluation and then that the parent comply with any treatment that's recommended. Sexual deviancy evaluation and, again, comply with treatment. Batters intervention program. Parenting classes, which I think are really great for everybody. I take them all the time. And I still have a tiara that my children gave me as meanest mom in the world. But the parenting classes are good. Conditions of probation and parole, this may not be for a sex offense. There could be domestic violence. There could be a DWI. There could be, some sort of other assault. So if the parent has any kind of criminal justice involvement, that they comply with those conditions. And again, I'm sure that you all have thought of things. Okay, here's a good, a really good point. Thank you, Becca. Please mention that even phone calls can be supervised. Absolutely. So if the child and some parents, especially parents who live far apart, are having visitations via Skype. Those can be supervised so that so it's in a safe place, and the parent is not saying inappropriate things, inappropriate signals, messages, anything to the child through the phone call. Really great point. Thank you. Treatment orders, if you ask the court to order the offending parent into a treatment program, you should, and that can be part of a parenting plan. So as part of the conditions of visitation, let's say the parent is ordered into substance abuse treatment. Request that progress reports be submitted to the court and to the other party on a regular basis. And that the court order should say that the party ordered to treatment shall sign a release so that this information can be shared with the court. Clear language in the parenting plan, what happens if the parent, goes to two treatment sessions and then quits? Rather than making the protective parent go back to court and try to enforce the order, is there something that's sort of self-actualizing, like if they don't complete it, if they don't continue to participate, they don't get visitation. If there are problems where the person is, let's say, in substance abuse treatment, if there are problems with visitation, the protective parent should be able to call the treatment provider and say, your client showed up drunk for a visitation exchange. I always put in, and I didn't put it in the slide, I always put in also in my parenting plans that they shall successfully complete. It's not enough just to go and show up. You know, if they want any change in the visitation, they have to be successful in participating in the treatment. Not okay just to pay your money and mail it in. You gotta do it. I put in here consider the financial resources of the parents because the court will consider that, and we should just be aware of it. And it's always on the front of my mind because my clients are very low income. And when they're ordered to do all sorts of things, sometimes they just cannot comply because they financially cannot find it, afford it, or there is no low-income sliding scale resources available in their community. So it's just something to be cognizant of. Decision-making is part of a parenting plan, and oftentimes when we're drafting parenting plans, we all want to make nice. And even in very horrible cases that I've worked on when there's been horrible abuse to a parent and or child, the parents will say, oh, we can have joint decision-making. Statute actually does not allow that. If there's been domestic violence and or sexual assault, there is no joint decision-making, period. You don't have to make nice with that parent. I actually, in my personal opinion, I think joint decision-making is way overused in parenting plans. You know, parents are not parenting together because they don't get along. They're either, you know, separated, getting divorced for whatever reason, never married. They don't get along. So we're saying, okay, you have to agree on making decisions for your child when, you know, you don't like each other. So even in the most run-of-the-mill divorces, I think joint decision-making is probably not really a great thing. And again, we all want to make nice. We all want to appear reasonable. Nobody wants to say, no, I don't trust my partner. I'm going to make the decisions. But maybe we should do that more often. I think it might bring down the level of post-separation, post-divorce conflict. While the child is residing with the parent, they get to make all emergency decisions. So, for example, abusive parent is having 2 hours of unsupervised visitation Sunday afternoon in a public place. They're at the playground, kid falls off the monkey bars and breaks his arm. That parent gets to call 911 and take the kid to the emergency room. They should also notify the other parent right away. Again, no dispute resolution process. For families that may get along, families that don't have high conflict, sometimes they can write into their parenting plan that they will go to mediation or counseling to try to resolve their disputes. And that works for parents who can kind of be reasonable and focus on the best interests of their child, not focused on punishing the other spouse. But too often we see parents using their child as a way to try to hurt the other parent in disputes. And if there is a history of sexual assault or domestic violence, there should not be any dispute resolution process except go back and talk to the judge about it. So just finally, you know, sort of best practices. These are things that you all probably know much better than I do. But really listen to the protective parent for his or concerns about what's being proposed for a parenting plan. Sometimes I have clients who say, you know, I think it's okay for unsupervised visitation, and I'm saying in my heart, no, no, no. But that parent might understand that if the abusive parent has an hour of unsupervised, they may feel less under attack and more willing to get help. So it's really, sometimes when I disagree with my clients, I realize it's me putting my value judgments on what I think should be happening and not on what the parent knows. I think parents really know what's good for their children. So be respectful of that and think creatively. There is no right. Sometimes there's a wrong if we give abusive parents, you know, primary custody, but in fashioning a protective parenting plan, there is no real right thing. Think creatively. Think about what will keep that child and that family safe. And here is my last slide, which is a happy slide because I think the work that you all do in working with families where there's sexual abuse, it's really hard, difficult, heartbreaking work, but it's so incredibly important. And, you know, I really commend you. You have my utmost respect for the work you do. And this is the work you do. You stand up for the children and really help them. And because you do that, you stand for everything. So I think we have 10 more minutes of my speed talking. And if you have any questions, please, let's see. Here's the final slide from Logan. I'm happy to have any questions if you want to put them in the chat box. And you may also please feel free to contact me directly on my email.
So, Leslie, I think we did have one from Karen. Have you ever come across someone saying they have been with a child for most of their life? They're not the bio parent, however, they are saying they are the psychological parent.
Yeah, there, you know, in fact, there's a Supreme Court case that came out about that just last week or 2 weeks ago. It's really called, it's called the de facto parenting doctrine. And it's really in flux right now in Washington State. And I am not a smart enough lawyer to tell you off the top of my head, what that parent needs to do. So, the seminal case was the case in Re MF. And it's several years old, and it was a case of two lesbian partners. One partner was the biological mom of the child. Both women had worked hard to raise this child together. The second mother had never formally adopted the child. And so when the mom split, the biological mom took the child and said the other mom could not have any visitation, and she went to court and said, really, I am the de facto parent of this child. I have raised her. I have nurtured her. I have held her out as my own. I have supported her. And the court said, yes, you have. You are a parent to this child. And I can't remember the case that just came out last week. It was a case where one dad thought he was the biological parent, raised the child of his own, found out when the child was several years old he was not the biological parent, and went to court and said, I've raised this child, I want to continue to be involved in her life. And the court said, okay. And I hope that answers the question. You know, the short answer is, it is just an area of law that's evolving right now, and so we tread lightly, we're real careful, but again, it's looking at what's best for the kids. That's the argument that I make.
And then I also wrote down that you wanted to maybe revisit something about the Relocation Act.
Oh, relocation. Thank you so much for that. Thank you. And, you know, I just had that aha moment about relocation this morning, and so I didn't put it into my slides. When there is a parenting plan and a visitation provision, the primary custodial parent does not get to move without giving the other parent notice. And for clients who are trying to stay safe, who maybe need to move to stay safe, excuse me, the Relocation Act can be a huge barrier to that. They can go to court and for good cause get permission from the court to relocate without giving notice. So someone I was talking to this morning said, you can write that into a parenting plan. I have never done that. I'm just throwing it out there. I'm going to consider that for a case in the future. So to write into the parenting plan to say the protective parent, the primary custodial parent, is able to relocate without giving the other parent notice. And this would be in a parenting plan. I think you could maybe get away with it in a parenting plan where there is no residential time for the abusive parent. But it's just something to keep in mind, because once there's a parenting plan, even if it's in a sexual assault protection order or a domestic violence protection order, and gives the offending parent any kind of, you know, 1 hour of visitation a week is visitation, and then it triggers the Relocation Act. So that's something just to be aware of. Did I say any? So here's one more question that I think we have time for. Someone says, unfortunately, our clients are often on the whim of whoever is on the bench that day, and often cannot afford legal assistance. And yep, I know it. And I wish I had a wonder, you know, I wish that everybody had right to counsel. I wish everybody, or at least every child, could have an advocate with them in court. And I wish that there was more and better training for judges. And it's a problem. I don't know the answer to it. Here's the last question. A client left spouse due to marital rapes. After leaving the relationship, discovered she was pregnant before relocating to another state. They have not been in contact for 6 months now. Well, maybe this is something, actually, this is kind of, this is a question from Libby. Libby, you have my email. Maybe I think we could talk about this case just because of client confidentiality. Can you just email me directly? And you have my email on the first slide, and I will email you back about that offline. And Libby says, okay. I'm confused because confidential address is not available to the opposing party. And I'm thinking that question applies to relocation. Even if the confidential address is not available to the opposing party, because if a parent relocates, it may change the availability. If they relocate far away, it may change the availability of the child for visitation, and there would need to be a change in the parenting plan. So, yes, a client with a confidential address should not have to disclose his or her address, but the Relocation Act still triggers. And last comment, I think then we're going to wrap up. It is imperative that we as advocates make sure that the judiciary is aware of our presence and commitment. As you mentioned, people tend to act a bit better when they know someone is watching, and that includes judges. And I think that's a really great point. And in King County, KSARC has had a really effective court watch, which I think has helped judges incredibly. And I think as advocates, I know that sometimes as a lawyer, part of my representation and my advocacy on behalf of my client is educating the judges. One quick example is this was many years ago when the judge was going to enter mutual protection orders. My client was a victim of domestic violence, and the court was going to enter mutual protection orders, and the opposing party had not followed the statute. The judge was just going to be like Solomon and just say, okay, you know, fie on both of you, I'm entering mutual orders. And so I stood up in front of the court and I said, well, in that case, Your Honor, I'm going to withdraw my motion for a protection order. And the court was stunned. Why would you do that? And then I had the opportunity to educate the court and say, Your Honor, it's so dangerous for my client for there to be a mutual protection order. That puts my client in grave danger. He can set her up. He can blah, blah, blah. And I had an opportunity to educate the court, and the court got it and entered a protection order only in favor of my client. And I think we can do that with all kinds of issues and, you know, work with your client, although as advocates often, you know, you're not able to speak in court. Work with your clients about what they can possibly say to help educate judges. Okay, Logan, I'm going to quit talking now, and I'll let you wrap up. And thank you all again very much for letting me do this with you.
Perfect timing. Thank you, Leslie, for just a wonderful training for our advocates across the state. I've put your intro slide back up on the screen in case people want to follow up with you directly with any questions. And as I mentioned, the recording from today and Leslie's slides will be on our website shortly, so please check back for that. And I think that will wrap things up for today. So thank you all for joining us. Take care.
Thank you. Please stand by.